are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Get your daily news fix by listening to The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Ears Edition. It's like The Daily Show, but it's for your ears. Studies show that ears are great for listening. And who are we to deny science? Trevor Noah and the world's fakest news team tackle the biggest stories in news, politics, and pop culture. Subscribe to The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Ears Edition, for highlights and extended interviews. It's available Tuesday through Friday mornings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your ears on a podcast.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Monday, September 10th, 2018. I am Michael Brooks. We are the Majority Report team, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Happy Jewish New Year, everybody.
Shana Tova.
Word. On today's program, seems like some of the concerns expressed by the Venezuelan government shockingly might have been true, as new reports that U.S. officials were meeting with members of the Venezuelan military in discussions and talks for a potential coup in that country. The Democratic Party of New York State has put out a vicious mailer accusing Cynthia Nixon of anti-Semitism because of her principled criticism of the human rights abuses of Israel. The GOP gubernatorial candidate for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, it's not just Facebook posts, he's also been speaking at white nationalist gatherings, apparently. Medicaid expansion is a key issue in gubernatorial races across the country. Mick Mulvaney taking a break from being Wall Street bagman and trying to undo financial regulations in the Trump administration spoke to donors in New York and said Ted Cruz might get taken out because, you know, likability does matter. Amazing on any number of levels, including the relative likability of Mick Mulvaney. Susan Collins is mum as the hits keep coming with Brett Kavanaugh. Is there legitimate questions of a perjury charge here? China's Muslim minority is being cleansed and the world says nothing. California Governor Jerry Brown commutes 20 murder convict sentences. Les Moonves is out at CBS. And Lula da Silva is giving up his run as that country's Supreme Court continues to block his candidacy, even though he leads by a vast gulf in the polls. Will his support transfer to his successor, Fernando Haddadi, as the fascist candidate was stabbed last week as Brazil's elections intensify and a non-lethal shot hit a Workers' Party candidate today, a black Brazilian Workers' Party candidate. Barack Obama is back out, and he's making sense and being incredibly annoying. We'll explain that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. I'm on Shabbos Goy duty. Usually I will be on Thursdays, obviously, but it's important Jewish holy days, and if anybody could use the resetting of a clock and a clean slate, it is Sam Steeder. We are much more spiritually clean. The whole team is here. Tucker Carlson is an important guy to understand. He really is the sort of mainstream Nazi whisperer of mainstream news in this country. There was a really good profile of him that was just done in the Columbia Journalism Review, which sort of captures his sort of the paradox and what really distills the time. We'll talk about later Steve Bannon in a $1,400 a night hotel room talking about why Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos are not elite. And in this great profile, the author her name's escaping me right now, of Tucker Carlson. She talks about the profound paradox of her as a freelance writer who might need to take a job at Starbucks to support herself and her family, living in Iowa, mind you, that she's the elite scold. And trust fund baby Swanson heir, cable news blowhard Tucker Carlson is somehow the bottom-up representative of the not-so-silent and, thank God, actually not majority of Americans. This is Tucker Carlson on Fox News. And, you know, he's quite – what's also revealing about that piece, though, is that for somebody who has a Fox News show, and I think even in his own self-concept, frankly, it's it really bothers him to be called racist. It actually really, really gets to him, which is a good lesson in terms of our programmatic plans. So let me just say this. Tucker Carlson is a racist.
Cosign.
By any meaningful definition of the term. And it's actually important to keep reaffirming that in the public discourse about him and him his ilk. And he's going to make our job easier and easier by doing segments like this.
What precisely is diversity our strength? Since you've made this our new national motto, please be specific as you explain it. Can you think, for example, of other institutions such as, I don't know, marriage or military units in which the less people have in common, the more cohesive they are? Do you get along better with your neighbors or your coworkers if you can't understand each other or share no common values? Please be honest as you answer this question.
So this is an incredibly disingenuous and sort of cynical frame, which is actually of his method, right? So first of all, you're conflating a lot of different things there. People might have a language barrier, but actually definitely share the same value sets. In fact, I have no doubt that there are people I've been covering it a lot. There's people in Brazil that don't speak any English, and God knows I don't speak any Portuguese. I have no doubt that I share a deeper value set than I do with the racist Tucker Carlson. So conflating all of those categories means very little. Secondly, yes, the stakes for two people in a marriage and the values that they share and how they may or may not communicate, although probably actually I could tell you not from marriage but from relationships, it might be better. At least in my instance, if we didn't speak the same language, we would probably argue less. But that being said, the notion that a marriage is the same as people that might live on your same block, is the same as people you might work with, is the same as people that you might share a broad national identity with, is actually an insane comparison. A country is not a marriage. A country is not a family. This is fascistic nonsense. We share civic, political, economic bonds. And there are a number of linkages that people build every single day between each other across all sorts of boundaries, which is the only way a country like this works. And a main reason for the success of this country has been, in the positive sense, an ability to absorb and create bonds from people across the globe. And that's something that Tucker Carlson, I'm sure, even though he's being chauffeured around in a car and even though he's making a living promoting this sort of subtext Daily Stormer content, sees living in New York City. But it's a good illustration of, in a way, those are sort of unanswerable questions because they're designed to be unanswerable. Like, we can pick apart how ludicrous they are because of the comparisons he's drawing. But more broadly, yes, cohesion's a good thing. And you're reducing cohesion to language.
Or culture.
Which is ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Yeah, he wants to mention other sorts of institutions where we look at diversity. How about something like baseball, where it's proven that culture is maybe less relevant to getting along and cooperating than, you know, being a good baseball player? That's why, like, my cousin plays minor league baseball. Like, he can't converse fluently with half of his teammates.
But they know
how to play the game together.
Well, and we also saw that great footage of the gentleman who lost his job, in fact, but at the UPS site. a black guy who saw all of the Mexican people walking off of the job site. You didn't need to precisely understand everything that everybody was saying in order to get who was in solidarity with who and what the right thing to do was.
Well, that's what these people are afraid of, right?
Yeah, there's
like,
no doubt.
They don't want us to have cohesion among the working class. So they're going to pretend like we can't while they enjoy the fruits of a cosmopolitan city and right. society. Like, if he wants to put his money where his mouth is, he can move to the middle of the country where everybody's white.
There's no doubt. But as I say, it's also just that rhetorical trick where, you know, and you see this like with Jordan Peterson a lot, right? Like, or anybody of that ilk. It's like you might make very abstract truisms. Like, in a world with no history, no context, no politics, nothing, right? Like, we're all just a blank slate, ironically, for the people who are constantly suggesting that the left believes we're just pure blank slates. These people want us to be political and historical blank slates. We don't know anything. There's no context for anything. There's no understanding of anything. Would you just treat everybody the same way, right? Would you repossess some land in South Africa just without knowing anything, right? There's no history. There's no background. There's no context. Yeah, probably not, right? Or should everybody be treated equally in some type of abstract way? Sure, I guess, whatever that means. Is cohesion an important thing? Yes. Arguably, Tucker Carlson, by promoting these conspiracy theories and nonsense and attempting to connect crime with immigration, by telling these fantasy narratives about America and culture, I would suggest he's undermining cohesion. I think there's a lot of cohesion that actually already exists in this country amongst people through bonds of work and community. And for normal people, it shouldn't freak you out and set off alarm bells and anxiety because, you know, God forbid you hear another language being spoken, or somebody might practice a different religion than you, or there's different food being cooked by you. Normal people don't get triggered by this. And there's actually cohesion around that. So you, by feeding these conspiracy theories and this division and these fantasies, you're creating a lack of cohesion. And you're, you know, again, when you're dealing with people of this political ilk, just be aware that all these word games are disingenuous. It's not a sincere proposition. Even if it was a sincere proposition, as I've said a million times, there can be community and civic initiatives to create, you know, dialogue between cultures, to figure out a community is really changing. Maybe it was monochromatic 3 years ago, and now all of a sudden there's a, you know, lot of new people in this town from different parts of the world. What does that mean for this community? How do people dialogue together? How do people create space for each other? That's totally valid. He's not talking about any of that. He's just giving you broad generalizations with stupid comparisons. Who you marry is not who you have to live in a community with, okay? In your own choice of who you marry, you can be as narrow-minded as you want to be. That's not your civic and political responsibility. Your community is. And it's an insane comparison. Anytime people start talking about family as country, your fascism bells should be just not a faint echo. That is it.
Yeah, that's some blood and soil shit right there.
That's blood and soil shit right there. Exactly. Tucker Carlson's a racist.
Did anybody know off the top of their head Tucker's middle name?
No.
So it's, it's in here, I think.
Is it Swenson?
It's like Swanson, Tucker right? Swanson McNair Carlson. Something nice. Good. Like
remember names. When he was just like a wacky nerd with a bow tie?
Sort of. Yeah. I remember that.
Tucker McNear Swanson Carlson.
The fuck out of here. All right, we have a few ads, and Sam likes reading the ads so much. He really enjoys telling you about these great products that we did not want to rob him of that joy. So here is Sam, and I also think it's funny that he made Matt stay late on Friday to record these things. So here is Sam to tell you about today's advertisers, and then we will be right back.
Hey, folks. Sam here. It is, of course, Rosh Hashanah. So I am not in studio today, but I did shave because when I go to Shul to celebrate the New Year's and then I go see my family, I don't want to have any growth on my face. I want to look sharp. How do I do it? You know how I do it. Harry's. Harry's founders know that a great shave comes down to great blades. They're made with sharp, durable steel that lasts. That's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world. But they're priced much lower than the leading brand. And they even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave, as long as you know, let them know within 30 days. And folks, if you can't figure out that you didn't like your shave 30 days later, then forget it. You're never going to know. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades. They created a $13 value trial set. Comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. The weighted ergonomic handle, my favorite. A five-blade razor with lubricating strip and the trimmer blade. I'm a big fan of the trimmer blade. I mean, I like the lubricating strip. I find that comfortable. Five-blade shave, of course. Shaves closely. But the trimmer blade, that's what seals the deal for me, because we know my famous asymmetry in my nostrils. Rich lathering shave gel, travel blade cover. You can claim yours by going to harrys.com/majoritypart. You get all those things. $13. The handle, the blade, the shave gel, the travel blade cover, all of it for $13. Now our listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majoritypart. You go to harrys.com/majoritypart to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. Last one is this. We got one more. Folks, Sam again. I am off in a undisclosed location celebrating Rosh Hashanah. That means that I am not sleeping on the most comfortable mattress I have ever slept on. Why? Because my Casper is back at home. Casper is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. They got three mattress models. They got the original Casper. That's the one I have. In fact, that's the two I have and one I bought my mom. The Wave and the Essential. Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Not to mention, the breathable design helps you to sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. That is true. I mentioned last time that I was there was a time where I was a little sweaty at night, and I got a gross from somebody. It's delivered right to your door in a small how-do-they-do-that size box with free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. It is pretty amazing. Saul was super psyched to see that thing like inflate itself. It doesn't really inflate itself, but it sort of feels, it just sort of expands. Best part, you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. Sleep on it for 100 nights. On 99th, I don't like it. Send it back. You spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable, folks. You know I love my Casper mattress, and one of the best things about my change in marital status is that I get to get my own Casper. You get $50 toward your select mattresses by visiting casper.com/majority and using majority at checkout. So that's casper.com/majority. And then you use the offer code majority for $50 off your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply, but do it now. casper.com/majority, offer code majority.
Boom. Hello. That's how it's done. You remember a couple of weeks ago, we actually talked about this much more extensively on TMBS. There were a couple of small drones that were packed with explosives in an apparent attempt to assassinate Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. Going back for the entirety of the Trump administration, there have been comments like a year ago when Mike Pompeo was the head of the CIA, quite openly talking about regime change. Rex Tillerson, when he was Secretary of State, spoke out of both sides of his mouth, on one hand saying that they wouldn't support a coup, but at the same time saying when the military sees things being so bad, they look to things like a peaceful transition, whatever that means. Donald Trump has spoken regularly about why there hasn't been regime change in Venezuela. He said it both publicly and privately. And we already know that the Venezuelan government of Maduro, which I think, you know, intellectual honesty does in this case require us to say, has very much created its own failings. Okay. And fortunately, some of them do go back to Chavez, but they've been accentuated under Maduro. And there was always a really mixed record and trajectory to the Venezuelan, the Bolivarian Revolution. We'll touch on that in a second. But that being said, and Nicolas Maduro has said the United States is trying to instigate a coup here. He was mocked by foreign policy pro John Oliver. And now, shockingly enough, and if I may, and this is going to come as a real surprise to the John Oliver writing staff. I don't know why I pick on John so much, but I mean, look, this is just so ridiculous. The idea that you wouldn't take seriously what administration officials were saying themselves. And going back to the, and we'll go to Bush and Obama in a second, but the New York Times reports over the weekend that the Trump administration has had secret meetings with rebellious military officers from Venezuela over the last year to discuss their plans to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro, according to American officials and former Venezuelan military commander who participated in the talks. Establishing a clandestine channel with coup plotters in Venezuela was a big gamble for Washington, given its long history of covert intervention across Latin America. Many in the region still resent the United States for backing previous rebellions, coups, and plots in countries like Cuba, Nicaragua, Brazil, and Chile.
What?
And for turning a blind eye for abuses of the military regimes committed during the Cold War. So the dialogue took place with military officers in Venezuela. It's really important to note that the sanctions regime that we have on Venezuela is obviously along with decision-making by the Venezuelan government and also by the oligarchs in Venezuela are doing two things. They're targeting the economic activities of the population. There's always the theory here that if you squeeze and you hurt people enough, there will be dissatisfaction with government. That's part of what we're doing with the coup, with targeted sanctions. The other part of the U.S. sanctions regime is almost micro-targeted to disrupt the businesses and the influence of the military to help facilitate a military intervention. And there's no doubt that the military has always been a major part of the Bolivarian government. Chavez came from the military. He initially tried to gain power in a left military action, which failed. He was then elected to the presidency democratically in the late 90s. And there were those two trajectories from the start. He used he used nationalization and other, we'll get to that tweet in a second, that's perfect, to nationalize industries. He definitely cut poverty. He created key redistributive policies during his time. He also concentrated power. He also clearly did and engaged in some legitimate and well-documented human rights abuses. He also clearly did not create a political culture with a good enough successor. Right. And like a sort of broader training to keep a political project going. And he rode to some extent an oil and commodity boom that wasn't set up for sustainable trajectory. And I'm going to quote now. This is actually from Noam Chomsky in 2017. Speaking to Amy Goodman, she asks, what about Venezuela? Noam Chomsky says, Venezuela is really a disaster situation. The economy relies on oil to a great, probably greater extent than ever in the past, certainly very high. And the corruption, robbery, and so on has been extreme under the, especially after Chavez's death. So if you look at it, it still has, if you look at, say, the UN Human Development Index, Venezuela still ranks above, say, Brazil. So it's fine. There are hopes and possibilities for reconstruction and development, but the promise of the early years has been significantly lost. So that's the political context we're in. And of course, from a simple, you know, a simply perspective, obviously we would have to oppose and should oppose all U.S. efforts and interventions to destabilize and undermine the Venezuelan government, which are ongoing. In 2002, and there's mixed reporting on this, some documents that were released actually suggest that the Bush administration warned off the coup plotters. But certainly, there was a 48-hour coup, literally, in 2002, which temporarily removed Hugo Chavez from power. The New York Times, after it happened, praised the coup, and the Bush administration immediately recognized the coup government. It was overturned by popular sentiment, and Chavez was literally flown back to the palace by military officers who supported him in maintaining at that time what was indisputably his democratic hold on power. There was a piece from The Guardian, though, back but was reported in 2010, that said a failed coup in Venezuela was closely tied to officials in the U.S. government, the Observer has established. They have long history in the dirty wars in the 1980s and links to death squads working in Central America at the time. And basically what it shows is that Venezuelan coup plotters met with U.S. officials in the Trump administration, including Elliot Abrams and Otto Reich. Otto Reich is a right-wing Cuban. I'm quoting now again from The Guardian. Otto Reich is a right-wing Cuban who under Reagan ran the Office for Public Diplomacy. It reported in theory to the State Department, but Reich was shown by congressional investigators to report directly to Reagan's national security aide, Colonel Oliver North, in the White House, of course, Colonel North of Iran-Contra infamy. Reich also has close ties to Venezuela and was made ambassador to Caracas in 1986. His appointment was contested by both Democrats and Washington political leaders in Latin America. The objections were overridden as Venezuela sought access to the U.S. oil market. The United States and Venezuela have not exchanged ambassadors since 2010. The Obama administration aggressively ramped up sanctions against Venezuela as well. And the military piece matters because there's no doubt that the military is involved in drug smuggling and other sort of key underground industries, which help prop up different informal and, you know, black market networks in the Venezuelan government. Obviously, we know, of course, the Trump administration, U.S. foreign policymakers could – I don't even know if to say they could care less about human rights abuses or connections to drug trafficking would be inaccurate. They might even prefer, you know – in fact, they clearly would prefer military people from the military who would be less hostile to U.S. foreign policy but were still involved in those areas and those human rights abuses. And the people that they were meeting with, according to the Times reporting, were heavily implicated by the State Department, all of those activities that we just outlined. So I'll just quote again briefly from the report. One of the Venezuelan military commanders involved in the secret talks was hardly an ideal figure to help restore democracy, as if this is the goal. He is on the American government's own sanction list of corrupt officials in Venezuela. He and other members of the Venezuelan security apparatus have been accused by Washington of a wide range of serious crimes, including torturing critics, jailing hundreds of political prisoners, wounding thousands of civilians, drug trafficking, and collaborating with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, which is considered a terrorist organization by the United States. American officials have eventually decided not to help the plotters, and the coup plot was stalled, but the Trump administration's willingness to meet several times with mutinous officers intent on toppling a president in the hemisphere could backfire politically. I would say, to say the least, it could backfire. And also, we don't know. This report is that those meetings took place and the talks broke down for a variety of reasons. There still was that bizarre attempt of a couple of weeks ago, which the Venezuelan government has pointed their finger directly at Colombian involvement, and it might link to some right-wing networks in Miami. So there's really no... All we know out of this reporting is that those meetings took place. And there's clearly a strong U.S. interest in a coup in Venezuela. There's no reason to think that just because talks might have broken down with a particular network of military officers, that there aren't other tracks ongoing and there isn't a keen interest in that policy. Marco Rubio has been instigating against Venezuela as well. And that sort of obviously ties to the far right sort of Cuban Floridian politics, which is another important part of the piece here. I'll just quote one more. This is from a top-level diplomat who served in the Obama administration. There are differences of opinion. Miss Aponte, the former top Latin American diplomat under Mr. Obama. There are people who had a lot of faith in the idea that they could bring about stability and help distribute food and work on practical stuff. But others, including Miss Aponte, saw considerable risk in building bridges with leaders of a military that, in Washington's assessment, has become a pillar of the cocaine trade and human rights abuses. So you see what's happening here, right? There are legitimate criticisms to have of the Venezuelan government, and people who won't make those criticisms aren't being real about a full assessment of the situation. But the U.S. foreign policy of interest in a coup and sanctions packages that are designed to instigate a coup will literally empower and directly inform a rise to power of the very factions of the present Venezuelan power structure that are most profoundly implicated in the things that we pretend that we don't like. So what will happen if there is a rightward U.S.-backed coup in Venezuela right now is there will be maybe a change in terms of what cocaine distribution networks were involved in, because maybe it will move to rightward cocaine distribution networks and away from the FARC. But cocaine smuggling doesn't just stop. And cocaine smuggling is not a political project. It's literally the business of the Venezuelan military. And it is a key transport hub from Colombia to ports in Trinidad and Tobago, as an example. The human rights abuses of suppressing and silencing critics and so on, you think that's going to stop because there's a different name of a Venezuelan government? And you think that the oligarchs who have hated Chavez and Maduro for all of the wrong reasons, for particularly under Chavez, delivering some key resources to the poor and doing some significant reversals to Venezuelan inequality, these people are going to all of a sudden keep the social gains that were available for a brief moment in the Bolivarian Revolution, and they're going to stop the human rights abuses and structural issues in the military? I mean, if you think this, obviously you're living in a fantasy land. And if you think that U.S. foreign policymakers care about human dignity in Latin America, you know less than nothing. So, I mean, I think just the conclusion is that don't dismiss Maduro's trash in many ways, but they're not lying about what the U.S. is up to. And that was obvious to anybody who knew anything. And the alternatives that will come through a military coup will empower, undoubtedly, the most retrograde parts of this power structure and delegitimize and destroy and probably wind up killing and putting in jail what small remnants remain of progress of what came out of what was once really a very promising political experiment, which unfortunately was flawed from the beginning. But again, in the relative politics of Venezuela and Latin America, if you had a left perspective, you would at the very least would be sympathetic and interested in what Chavez was attempting, while being skeptical of his obvious authoritarian tendencies from the beginning.
So here's the question.
Yeah.
If we had a foreign policy based on, say, human rights and not capitalist imperialism, mm-hmm. is there anything we could do to make the situation better, or is the only thing to do just to keep our hands off?
Well, if you didn't, I mean, I think there's no doubt if they didn't have economic sanctions, it wouldn't be as pressured, right? Like, I mean, if you had resources flowing, it wouldn't be as pressured. I also know, I think they had to pull them back, but Cuba helped Venezuela a lot when they sent doctors and other medical professionals there during the Chavez era, which really helped like ramp up their health services. Cuba's quite advanced in that area. So maybe we could do things like that.
It's amazing to see the U.S. It sort of has these muscles it built up during the Cold War, and it just can't help itself. Anytime there's a situation like this, you know that there's meetings taking place to run those same plays, basically.
Exactly. And here's a good example of it. Richard Haass is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. and a very much, you know, sort of mainstream foreign policy Mandarin, and, you know, a guy that I'm sure is, you know, quite upset that the president is a mental case. He tweeted out, for those here and in the region who will be quick to criticize the administration for this, I ask you, what is your policy other than watching Venezuela become a failed state that is starving, crushing its people, and creating hundreds of thousands of refugees? Well, I just said, maybe you could keep targeted sanctions in place on people that you know are cocaine traffickers, but I would say lift sanctions with regards to broader economic activity. In fact, one policy could be is you could actually send in aid. You could actually send in resources. And you could say, regardless of our feelings about the failings of the Maduro government, we see a humanitarian problem here that we're going to try to plug. And how you could even pretend, even by like the most cynical standards of Washington. I understand if you're making foreign policy, it is not like doing a show and we are not in the world we want to be in yet. So there's always going to be inconsistencies and hypocrisies. That's just reality. But the notion that you're tweeting sympathetically about meetings that all had to do with instigating a military coup with people that are complicit and help create the situation you're talking about, in the same week that the Trump administration has cut off, I believe, $25 million from East Jerusalem in just a pure move of just being capricious. Like, we just want to harm Palestinians even more. And maybe it will give us a little fundraising bump. And maybe it will be a talking point at some stupid campaign rallies. The fact that you could even be out here pretending that this administration in general or meetings to potentially instigate a coup have something to do with a genuine concern for refugees or food shortages in Venezuela, and that the people who would criticize it, it's incumbent on us to design a completely different policy, is the most sort of whataboutist, disingenuous fucking bullshit I could imagine. I mean, it's just embarrassing to put this tweet out.
Yeah, the idea that sanctions could ever lead to a more democratic like situation for a country is so contrary to, like, obviously you need people taken care of before you can have a functioning democracy, which is why like democracy is clearly just a stand-in word for what they really want, which is sort of oligarchic order.
They want oligarchic order, of course.
And people, here's another thing about sanctions. Like, people think of sanctions as like this sort of gentler, non-violent option, but like their effects on people can be very bad. And like, you don't think of stuff like hunger as violence typically. Well, some people don't, but it really is. It is.
Of course. And I'm just going to pivot. I'll do this briefly, but I'm just going to pivot briefly to Brazil. Actually illustrates this too, in the sense that under the leadership of the Workers' Party and Lula da Silva, not only were between 30 and 50 million people taken out of poverty, hunger was considered to not be an issue in Brazil anymore by the United Nations. It was taken off the table. It doesn't mean that there was still not a lot of poverty, still not a lot of problems, but there were massive social gains. This is why Lula left office with an 84% approval rating. It's why the historian Barry Anderson in the London Review of Books called him the most successful politician in modern politics, which I find to basically just be an indisputable argument. I don't know another name you could give me in modern politics who we could even argue was remotely as successful as Lula da Silva. Under the Michel Temer government, which is the current austerity government, which came to power through removing Dilma Rousseff from office because of what were essentially accounting tricks that they didn't like, not even anything criminal. Hunger is now an issue again in Brazil, according to the UN. Brazil has become a right-to-work country. Poverty is increasing. All of the social indicators are going in the wrong direction. So look, you start with a place that obviously that you know has a better base condition than Venezuela, but just the notion that you're talking about these issues is something you care about when you have a far-right austerity government, which is immensely corrupt. Another police investigation was actually opened against Temer just last week. And Brazil's Natural History Museum burned last week. And part of the reason that the fire couldn't be taken care of was because I believe some of the fire hydrants didn't have water in them because of budget cuts. So,
what, you want water in them all the time?
You water in them all the time? That's super socialist and inefficient. So the Supreme Court of Brazil has ruled again and again. Lula is not going to be able to be on the ballot, even though he is the one who would almost get to 50% and win in the first round and definitely defeat the fascist candidate Bolsonaro. And I want to remind everybody, there's other investigations, there's other, you know, there's other questions. I think more broadly, the fact that Brazil has the second most money spent in campaigns after the United States says a lot about how this country works. And a lot of the broader corruption that might have been implicated in the Workers' Party really did have to do with funding campaigns and the price to pay to actually engage in power. And there's no doubt that, you know, Lula and Dilma were not a boy and girl scouts, right? But they actually wielded power to advance human well-being, which is still the basic dividing metric in my mind. And what they actually have put him in jail for, what he is serving a 12-year sentence for before all of his appeals are being exhausted, and what is excluding him from a participation in an election he almost definitely would win, is a condo, a beach apartment, of which he does not own the lease to. It is not clear that the ownership was ever transferred to him. And almost all of the testimony is from a business executive who wanted a shorter jail term for himself. And he has literally been convicted of unknown doings. So that's it. That's the case. I'm not saying that the guy is perfect. I'm not saying that other information might not come forward. But that is literally the case from which the Brazilian judiciary is blocking the most successful president in Brazil's history and in modern politics from running and defeating a fascist and taking Brazil out of an immense crisis, of which he clearly is the one with who, you know, ironically, by any actual global standard, this would be an example of a actual moderate defeating a fascist, which is what all these resistance and responsible people types say they want all the time. So hopefully the support will transfer to Fernando Haddad, the former São Paulo mayor. But the Brazilian military keeps making some very weird threats about what they might want to do in the election. And I wonder where all this rhetoric about human need and democracy will go then. Barack Obama, he's back on the town. Do we want to start with the yay or the nay? All right, we'll start with yay. This is President Obama. He gave a speech on Friday. If you recall, if you were watching the Majority Report, you'll recall that not only did he eviscerate the Trump administration, this guy is so good, he almost made Judy Gold bat for the other team.
Hitting the back walls.
Yeah, hitting the back walls. This is Barack Obama, and this was really important and very well stated. This is Donald Trump, and we've been saying this, and everybody who's really an analyst of these things has been saying this for a long time. Donald Trump is a symptom, not the cause.
Each time we've gotten closer to those ideals, somebody somewhere has pushed back. The status quo pushes back. Sometimes the backlash comes from people who are genuinely, if wrongly, fearful of change. More often it's manufactured by the powerful and the privileged who want to keep us divided and keep us angry and keep us cynical because that helps them maintain the status quo and keep their power and keep their privilege. And you happen to be coming of age during one of those moments. It did not start with Donald Trump. He is a symptom, not the cause. He He's just capitalizing on resentments that politicians have been fanning for years. A fear and anger that's rooted in our past, but it's also born out of the enormous upheavals that have taken place in your brief lifetimes.
So that's 100% right. I mean, there really isn't much to add to that. He's right about everything from the turmoil and upheaval of the time, which, look, if we want to spell it out, obviously is driven by capital, and it's driven by inequality, and it's driven by mass technological changes with no corresponding advancements for labor and social cohesion. But he is absolutely right that rightward politics, elite politics, is built and predicated on dividing people through demagoguery and other types of division so that the real sort of arrow of focus is not on addressing structural problems of power. He's 100% right, and it's beautifully put.
Yeah, I just wanted to underline the more often than not, more often than he said it's manufactured by those right from above than a real divide. And I think that's, like I've often said, I don't think we have a divided people. I think when people talk about how divided the voters are now, that's not the real issue here. The issue is we have a lot of different concentrated capital centers that have a very different idea of which direction they want the country to go, and they're fighting this out.
That's exactly right. And I think that there's also, you know, that's why you need to look literally at like a Jane Mayer book on the Koch brothers and on all of these oligarchs that fund these things.
Nancy McLean,
because literally that is the money, the mechanism through which, even when things are more organic, like part of the Tea Party was definitely organic. There were definitely people that really were freaked out, mainly racially and culturally. But the propaganda set that they have in front of them, the talking points about Obamacare, the fantasies about Medicare and Social Security, like that was all provided to them by the radio shows, by the websites, by the AstroTurf groups that are all funded by the oligarchs. So even when it's like, okay, there's a genuine sentiment behind it, and if it's on the right, the genuine sentiment is always basically going to be driven by bigotry and social freakout. And then the talking points, whether it be healthcare or immigration, are provided and preset by websites and other propaganda organs that are funded. I mean, look, we could agree that probably the Breitbart Trump continuum is probably the closest to some type of like actual uprising of the worst America has to offer, and it's real, and it's genuinely rooted in racism and sexism and misogyny and freakouts about the change of America. And the talking points and the template for them to operate is still a website that was not a successful business model and was funded by a dangerous weirdo oligarch family in Long Island. And that's where the talking points come from. That's where the context comes from. It is always manufactured.
This is all true, but I still don't think he's ready to accept any blame on the part of, say, globalized neoliberal capitalism, bad trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP, which he promoted on late night television. And not to mention how Obama dealt or did not deal with the banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis.
Definitely.
And this is feeding the fire.
Of course, 100%. And until that part is reckoned with, and look, Obama did, you know, I'm a better late than never person. So he came out and he said, raise the minimum wage, Medicare for all. He endorsed Elizabeth Warren's workers' board thing. Great. Nice. If he wants to go out and use his charisma and rhetorical skills to promote those policies during the fall, awesome. We should welcome that and appreciate that. And even also the worry like, oh, well, Trump wants this. Well, okay, Trump wants this, but 25% more Americans like Barack Obama than Donald Trump. Barack Obama is a superior human being in every way, shape, or form to Donald Trump. Donald Trump would not have won an election against any other candidate besides Hillary Clinton, to be blunt, okay? So I'm happy with that contrast. We need to have our own – everything you just said about Obama is 100% true, and that's why fundamentally you know, the neoliberal chorus, the center-right chorus, is not going to get us out of our predicament. But within that continuum, there's a difference. Emmanuel Macron is in France still trying to gut the French model and neoliberalize. Barack Obama's coming out and saying Trump is a symptom, not a cause, and Medicare for all. Great. That means he's tacking in our direction. That means that AOC is making more of a register in the national debate than some center-right Democrat whose name I honestly can't even think of, because there isn't any with any profile right now. Beto O'Rourke is running a solidly progressive campaign for Senate of in Texas. And Barack Obama, as the sophisticated trend-reading politician that he is speaking to it. Now, here he is as part of the area that Jamie just mentioned where, you know, he just doesn't get it. And now he's going to do some dadding to young people.
In the last midterms election, in 2014, fewer than one in five young people voted. One in five. Not two in five. Or three in five. One in five.
Whoa, Bob. Fucking A.
Is it any wonder this Congress doesn't reflect your values and your priorities? Are you surprised by that? This whole project of self-government only works if everybody's doing their part. Don't tell me your vote doesn't matter. I won states in the presidential election because of 5, 10, 20 votes per precinct. And if you thought elections don't matter, I hope these last 2 years have corrected that impression.
Okay, so look, let's actually start again where he's right about this. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, elections do matter. Your vote absolutely does matter. And everybody needs to go out and vote for Democrats in November, period. If you don't understand the importance of that, again, you're just not in reality. He's 100% right about that. On the other hand, I mean, this is a common Obama trope, and he's always said it, and I think it just misses two. One, it's like, look, Barack Obama got those extra people to turn out because Barack Obama is a charismatic, likable person, not because of a policy agenda per se. Maybe somewhat a policy agenda in 2012, but people really liked him. And the reality is that Hillary Clinton's campaign ran a campaign essentially built on an Obama model. And what they missed was that for all of the metrics and all of the supposed quantitative sophistication, the basic ingredient that set Obama apart is people like the guy. Unless you're a weirdo or a racist, right? Or both. You like Barack Obama. What's not to like? And so even with Mitt Romney, there were crazy polls where people said, oh, well, we trust Mitt Romney more on the economy. We trust Mitt Romney more on military issues, which are, I mean, just made no sense. But then there would just be this vast gulf on who's looking out for me as a person. And Obama just crushed him. And if you don't have that personal asset set, you cannot run the same campaigns. And then more broadly, dude, I don't know, man. You made some nice steps in some directions, okay? There's more people on Medicaid because of you. There was a stabilization of the crisis because of you. But I'm sorry, and particularly when you're lecturing young people, you didn't talk about universal student loan forgiveness. You didn't say that the first job right now is not to kind of faint to austerity as you did in 09 and 010, but to get more and more stimulus is going so that we can not just stop the bleeding, but actually get people in employment. You have a whole generation of people that actually went out and enthusiastically voted for you in very high margins relative to what they normally turn out, that have wage stagnation, depreciated a job and life prospects across the board. And of course, that goes back well before Obama, and the seeds of it go back to Reagan and deregulation, and they're accelerated by Clinton and Bush. But you didn't reverse the tide on that. You did not. That's objective reality. You were playing around with cutting Medicare and Social Security, trying to make John Boehner's drunk ass make an agreement with you. Not focusing like a laser beam on the student debt crisis and youth employment. And unless you did that, it's really not time for, come on, young people.
Yeah, it's just who's in the audience for that, right? Yeah. Those 1 in 5 people who voted are probably the 1 in 5 that are going to actually give a fuck that you're giving a speech now.
They're right? The 1 in 5 people tweeting, oh my God, I miss him. It was my first vote. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Like, we already know that. You're not doing anything.
I watched a Pod Save America guys on Colbert. Yeah. It was from August. I don't know why I watched it.
I don't know why either.
But they talked about the Omarosa book and Andrew Cuomo or the Governor Cuomo gaffe. And then they pitched before, and then they had a weird cut that made it seem like they might have got into Nixon Cuomo and then cut that out for airing. Right. And then they go right to Pod Save America's proprietary voting, votesaveamerica.com, which is, I assume, they collect your email and then just like shuffle you off to a website that gives that you probably should go to get your voting registration info. Right, like it's
so just a giant, basically just an email collection.
Yeah,
for company.
It's just completely devoid of any sort of pointed ideological or policy statement. It's just like, let's laugh about Omarosa, and you know, say something not even interesting about the horse race.
And also, Obama at his best would say like, you know, I'm a community organizer, and isn't just voting. You got to go out and do other stuff. And it's like, well. Especially with the really important parts of that speech where he articulated the depth of the crisis we're in. Wasn't this also the time to say that while it's essential and non-negotiable that you go out and vote? And I can't underscore that enough. I have anybody who comes with any dumb arguments in this election cycle or in 2020. I mean, obviously, I think they should have already been dismissed in 2016. But I mean, there is no room for that kind of stupidity heading into these elections. But at the same time, was this not also the time to say that politics isn't just a 2-year cycle that you register a preference on, that you have to be much more deeply involved because there's a broad assault on both what we need for the future and also the hard-won gains of the past?
Well, that's been the message for a pretty long time now, I think. Like at Aussie Fest, I know I keep going back to this, but this is the establishment Democrat neoliberal line is all you could do. All you really need to do is vote for Democrats. That's the most important thing. And like maybe go to a protest once in a while that Hillary Clinton's going to take credit for in a video montage that's ridiculous. But like if I thought that browbeating young people who probably aren't watching to vote would make them vote for Democrats, I would be fine with it. But it's not going to have the outcome that he wants it to have or that we should want it to have. And like,
I think he could have said, you know, he could have said, look, I'll give you both messages. One is like, I'll just say this myself. I'll keep emphasizing it's fucking inexcusable and ridiculous to not understand the importance of voting. And it's inexcusable and ridiculous to not see the difference between a Hillary Clinton and a Donald Trump, as trash as Hillary Clinton is. And at the same time, maybe a time to say, you know what? And I also apologize that all of your enthusiasm and all of your hope and all of your energy, yes, it did translate into certain things that we did. And he can clock off the list of some of his achievements that he feels most proud of, right? And some of which did make a real material difference in people's lives. But he can say, like, I know the student debt crisis was out of control under my presidency. I didn't do enough. I tried to do X, X, and X, but that wasn't enough. I know that your wages stagnated. I know that your employment prospects went down. I know that all these things happened, and I know we need to do more. And this also really matters. And Trump is doing, and the Republicans are going to do this, this, and this to make it that much more worse. There's a way of actually having a balance there where you also just treat people, you know, with a little bit of reality. Because the old notion that it's like, oh, well, young people are just not voting just because they're lazy. And it's like, guys, like, you cannot keep having because the most people who sort of shame, you know, young people for not voting are like celebrities and politicians. And it's like, guys, like Generation X and baby boomer multimillionaires hectoring you for not doing something after you did not get delivered for is just bad optics, to say the least.
Yeah, I wonder what possibly could have happened during the Obama years that would convince young people that maybe the Democrats aren't looking out for their best interests. I wonder.
Well, and really,
he ran on like a broad sort of class-based populist appeal, kind of.
I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, he at least rhetorically, he got a lot of people in the Rust Belt to vote for him that didn't vote for Hillary, right? Some of whom
he ran in 08 as a real cultural cleanser. And I mean, it was a different time. Like, it just was a different politics. And I think one way in which we've gotten better, particularly in Democratic voters and generally, is I don't think, like, even look at, like, now Cory Booker doesn't have Barack Obama's talents, but like, I'm sure by all inclinations, he'd want to run that kind of campaign of like, we're just going to do better and come together. And everybody's going to be like, yeah, whatever. What's your plan on healthcare? That wasn't what was going on in 08.
Well, he certainly, he did a better job than Hillary did at it, let's just say. Of course. Which is like a very low bar.
That's like comparing like LeBron and the guy that we played that was like in the Spanish league.
Like. Then he came in and he couldn't even pass card check.
Yeah.
So then when Hillary comes in and she's running an even more like leading with our values, where Trump is bad, that kind of campaign, like of course people aren't going to fall for that.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it rhetorically reads like it just seems like blame displacement. And just functionally speaking, in terms of political rhetoric, it's obvious that the shit he said about Medicare for All is going to be much more helpful in getting those four out of five
right.
voters than hectoring them.
Exactly.
And the hectoring is just that it seems just psychically like a need for people, liberals, to like say, hey, this is on the people. It's not, and like, I do not blame voters for Donald Trump. I think if you do blame them, you don't have a good enough understanding of the oligarchy that we live in. So, but putting that in the foreground, that's the problem. And, you know, like, it's all true what he says about elections mattering, but foregrounding it and spending that much time when it isn't going to hit the ears that you need it to hit is just—it's just useless.
Right.
Yeah, leave the hectoring to us, Obama. Okay, yeah. We will talk to our fellow cynical millennials and tell them what's up.
And
you
also
can talk about Medicare for All.
That's the truth. And also, you know, and to be clear, when we talk about like dumb left, we're talking about like people at platforms and commentators.
Yeah. I think
voters. People who vote, it's really clear. I think that, as we always say, over 90% of people that voted for Donald Trump are Republicans. And the task of politics is to frustrate and thwart and destroy those people politically. That's it. And then for the handful of people that were taken in by the scam, we welcome them back with a clear, robust left-wing economic message and class solidarity, like Jamie talks about, 100%. And then, I mean, that's basically it. There isn't really any more to talk about. That's one of the reasons that debate gets so goddamn frustrating, is we all know the answer to it. All right, we are going to go to the fun half where we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.it. Become a member. Leave the Majority Report a iTunes review. Subscribe to the Majority Report on YouTube. You know all the ways you can do this. On the Michael Brooks Show tomorrow, we are doing a September 11th sort of policy retrospective. And then Doug Lane from Zero Books is coming on to talk ideology. This Sunday, Illicit History of the War on Terrorism with Derek Davidson. And next week, Crew, Alone and Minkowski returns. And then following that, I believe Matt Taibbi is coming back. So this past Sunday, we did an Illicit History of Lula da Silva and the Workers' Party. So I said, like, I do think all of these things, like, one of the things that strikes me is that Bannon is actually a globalist. He actually thinks in terms of globally synchronized, far-right, bigoted governments from Brazil to Australia. And that's why we need actually a global left focus, because all of these things are going to impact and reflect on each other. And particularly if we're thinking proactively of the time of, say, as an example, Jeremy Corbyn's prime minister, Bernie Sanders as president. Like where capital goes, how the judiciary responds to it. There's a lot of lessons and a lot of important things to draw from that. And that's a big part of some of the conversations and research that we do on TMBS. So please become a patron today. We are well. Oh, and also, not only when we hit 2,000 patrons, which now we're, I think, under like four or a little, we're under 400 away from that next goal. We're going to eat the disgusting Glenn Beck food bucket, and that's going to be hilarious and terrifying. There's also a second compilation video of my impressions has been put together, and it's not going to be released until that target is hit. So patreon.com/TMBS. Also, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel now at regular clips. Add that to your diet. We're just shy of our first 7,000 subscribers. We appreciate all of it. Thank you. Jamie. We got to complete hello. The pitches.
Hello, hello. Yes. So, thank you. Yes. We have just released a new, I'll call it a segment of the Antifada called History is a Weapon, which is the first installment of our new series about history and theory, in which, in this one, Sean really breaks down what historical materialism is and how it is a powerful tool for understanding capitalism, not as an ahistorical force of nature, but an economic system, a system of production that arose from a unique set of historical conditions and material conditions in history, which, you know, clearly points us, I think, in the right direction in terms of how to fight and dismantle it on a very pragmatic level. Also, we just recorded an episode yesterday with comedian Jake Flores. And in this episode, we talk with Jake about this week in Elon Musk, how Jake became a socialist, the relationship between comedy and politics, being a socialist in a very competitive and individualistic and sometimes crazy-making industry, and comrade Keith Cocaine Hernandez. Check it out, folks. That'll be out on Wednesday.
Literary Hangover. Two things coming up. We're going to do Scarlet Letter.
Sweet.
And also Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind.
Oh, that's a very good book.
We're going to start veering into some of the more... the things people need in their canon of sort of left progressive
literature. I like
literature.
It. I like
and
it.
And that's the first choice. Because it's been a while since I read it, but I think there's a really good Scalia takedown in there, if memory serves. And so we're just going to get into that stuff. So
dancing.
Yeah, exactly.
Scalia.
Check it out. Patreon.com/literary hangover.
All right, perfect. We'll be right back. See you on the fun half.
Poopy.